from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, wherever you are. I am Rob Watson, and you are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. And I'm going to assume it's evening, although this is available in podcast form, so you could be listening to it in the morning or any other time of day, which we are really, really pleased if you do so. But if you're listening to us live, it is either later at night or evening, or even in Hawaii, it's probably around dusk. But in any case, we are very glad you're joining us. As you know, we feature the LGBTQ newsmakers of the day, the top stories, the people who are in the thick of the issues, and tonight is no exception to that. On board, of course, is my co-host, Brody Levesque, the esteemed journalist. But we are going to be talking to the new editors of the campus fashion magazine, Couture Magazine, which I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly, that it is a cross between couture and culture. But this is a fashion and lifestyle magazine that has as its charter to challenge the beauty standards by encouraging readers to accentuate their best features, rather than being conformist with unrealistic societal expectations. And this magazine delivers this message actually to the campus of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, which we are assuming, Brody and I are assuming, that that might be somewhat of a more conservative leaning campus than others that it could be, which makes the charter of this magazine probably even more revolutionary than it might otherwise be in say a New York campus or a California campus. But we're going to find out more about that when we have our special guests on, who are Cassandra Cassidy and Patrick Rosemond, and they are standing on deck waiting anxiously to come on and tell us about how they are changing the world through fashion and culture and everything beautiful. Before we get to them, however, I do want to welcome to the show, as I said, my esteemed co-host, Brody Levesque, with a few of the stories of the day, including, Brody, a late-breaking story.
That's true. Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners across the globe and in the United States. 27-year-old Oliver Knight was lying on a gurney in a pre-surgical holding area on August 30th of 2017, and he was hooked up to an IV drip. He was waiting on the general anesthetic to be administered, and otherwise he was completely prepped for a routine hysterectomy procedure, because he's trans, when his surgeon approached and informed him that the hospital's executive administrators had canceled his surgery. The reason for the cancellation was detailed in a 12-page civil lawsuit that was filed earlier today in Superior Court for Humboldt County, California, by Knight, who is a resident of Eureka, against St. Joseph Hospital, which is also located in Eureka. In a phone call I had earlier today with Elizabeth Gill, who's a senior attorney with the ACLU Foundation of Northern California, she says that the principal reason that the surgery was denied was that it, quote, conflicted with the hospital's adherence to Catholic doctrine and beliefs. Now, St. Joseph Hospital is part of the Providence St. Joseph Healthcare Network. This is a national Catholic not-for-profit healthcare system. Happens to be one of the largest ones in the United States. It operates about 51 hospitals, probably has about 25,000 physicians. And in the state of California, it actually operates 18 hospitals. And what's even more critical in California is most of these hospitals are in smaller jurisdictions like Eureka and smaller rural areas. So they are literally, as in the case of Eureka, the only place you could go. In my conversations with Gil, she pointed out that the hospital regularly allows hysterectomies for patients who are not trans, and noted that Knight's physician had said that he and the other physicians regularly perform these procedures. So the discriminatory denial here, according to Gil and the ACLU, was because Knight, of course, is trans. Now, one of the things we need to note on this, okay, Gil told me that Knight's being denied health care based on the hospital's religious views, which does not recognize gender-affirming care, which in this case it would since the person is a trans man, is actually a violation of California public accommodations laws, which are governed by California's UNRRA Civil Rights Act, and under there that basically if you are any kind of institution like a hospital and you are open to the public for operation, which is the case, okay, with St. Joseph, then they've more or less just violated the law by denying that particular procedure. Now, the young man wrote a blog post, and one of the things that he wrote in there, in the blog post, and this is kind of disconcerting. Now, this took place in 2017. I'm just going to read this one section, Rob. On August 30th, I arrived at the hospital. They checked me in and did the surgery prep, which was extremely uncomfortable and, quite frankly, triggering. I was given a pink gown. I asked the nurse if I could have a blue gown, and she told me I was having a female surgery and will have to wear the pink. I felt like a child all over again, sitting uncomfortably in a pink dress, but I forced myself to do it. I had been waiting so long for this surgery. And then, of course, at the end of the day, he didn't get the surgery. So it's really unfortunate, you know, Rob, in overall terms, when you look at these circumstances, especially with, you know, a situation like this where, you know, these young people are encountering this kind of thing. And again, it's based on just religious prejudice. Now, in a notation to that, and it's part of the story, let me finish. This also has to do with the Equality Act, which was just reintroduced in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops. Now, these are the people that actually oversee, including this healthcare network, okay? They issued a letter, and this was reported by the Catholic News Agency, the three top bishops in the conference, okay? And this is their objection. The Equality Act purports to address issues of discrimination. However, it would create new problems and threaten fundamental religious freedoms. Then the bishops went on and they said, okay, that the act would also remove women and girls from protected legal existence. And that's kind of important to note because this has been part of the religious rights argument and the Catholic argument on that. And then later on in the letter, okay, they raised the issue of a lack of criteria for gender identity, which could open the door for abuses in restrooms and locker rooms. And, of course, you and I have talked about that numerous times over the last couple of years. So these are the two parts of the story together. And this is just the initial stages of the lawsuit. I will probably come back at a later date and have more information once we get into the discovery process in the American Civil Liberties Unions. And I talk again.
Right. So, and leaving the civil rights aspect of this and the religious freedom violation, mm-hmm. you know, or stepping in and trying to override somebody's religious beliefs on top of a civil rights, especially here in California, mm-hmm. where those civil rights are protected. The biggest question I have about this story is mm-hmm. has almost nothing to do with that. It has to do with the absolute cruelty of it on why the hell did they wait until this young man was waiting to go into surgery. To his point, he'd been waiting forever. And I know so many transgender people who have fought for the right to have different surgeries, and all of that process and the denial of it, and then finally being able to have it done and what that all entails. Why the hell was he in the hospital waiting to have it and have them deliver the news at that point? That is unconscionable. I mean, regardless of the fact that they were completely wrong, how did they get away with pulling that timing and that cruelty?
Well, I did a little bit of research on that. And from what my understanding is, and this is true of almost any Catholic hospital, you have a professional healthcare administrator. The person, and these people are long experienced in healthcare administration, be it hospitals or clinics or systems. But in each of these hospitals, then you also have a representative of the Catholic Church. And in most cases, it's either a senior nun or a Monsignor or a reverend. And apparently, he was scheduled for surgery first thing in the morning. And as routine, apparently the, you know, reverend was going through the surgical and other records with the administrator and apparently noticed the name, and it was incongruous with the gender and the type of surgery. And the minute that happened, there was phone calls, you know, to the archdiocese. There was phone calls. You have to forgive me. I've got puppies. There was phone calls to the archdiocese, and there was phone calls that, you know, went back and forth, and ultimately the hospital administrator was forced to tell the surgeon, you know, pull him out of his prep for the surgery and say, that's it, you know, done, cannot do it. So, and I'm sure there'll probably be more about what happened and took place in that regard once they go through the discovery process. So,
yeah,
it's cruel.
It's an outrageous story from in principle alone, but the behavior of the administrator and just the absolute cruelty, the expectations of this patient, and you know what he has had to do to prepare himself to be ready for this surgery. You know, I hope that they go for additional damages just on, and I don't mean this term in the flippant way it's usually used, but emotional distress that they've caused him. That is outrageous, and just in itself, regardless of their reasoning behind it. It's ridiculous. But speaking of emotional distress and the distress that we all get put through pretty much on a daily basis, thanks to the orange one who happens to sit in the Oval Office. He did it again today. And since our theme tonight is somewhat collegiate, let's talk about that for a minute. Tell us about the executive order that came out of him regarding colleges today.
President Donald Trump Thursday signed an executive order that would deny colleges certain federal research and educational grants if they failed to comply with free speech standards as outlined by the administration. Quoting the president, under the guise of speech code and safe spaces and trigger warnings, these universities have tried to restrict free thought, impose total conformity, and shut down the voices of great young Americans. All of that changes starting right now. We're dealing with billions and billions and billions of dollars, Trump said, surrounded by student activists at a White House ceremony Thursday afternoon. In doing so, Trump is responding to a rallying cry among conservatives who say their views are suppressed on campuses and that speakers are sometimes assaulted or silenced when protesters threaten violence. Trump called the move historic, saying that the students and American values have been under siege, as several students said free speech is at risk on their campuses. Every year, the federal government provides education with more than $35 billion in research funding. All that money is now at stake. That's a lot of money. They're going to have to not like your views a lot, Trump said. The executive order basically directs 12 grant-making agencies to work with the Office of Management and Budget to ensure that universities are complying with federal law in an effort to promote free speech on college campuses. The thing here is, and this even comes from the Republican side. Tennessee Republican Lamar Alexander, who's the chair of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, said that, and basically his statement was, he didn't want to see Congress or the president or the department, okay, of anything creating speech codes to define what you can say on campus. And quoting the senator, the U.S. Constitution guarantees free speech. Federal courts define and enforce it. The Department of Justice can weigh in. Conservatives don't like it when judges try to write laws, and conservatives should not like it when legislators and agencies try to rewrite the Constitution, Alexander said. This whole thing really, the genesis to it is an organization of young conservatives in an organization called Turning Point USA, led by a young man by the name of Charlie Kirk. I'm going to go off the reservation here because this is one time I just can't hold back. In the parlance of my fellow journalists, Charlie Kirk is an ignorant, flaming, fucking moron. And the problem is that these people want to be able to be homophobic. These people want to be xenophobic. These people want to be racist. These people want to be white supremacists. They want to use code words. You know, free speech is not being impugned. The real truth is here is these universities are blocking a lot of these speakers, including our dear friend Milo, who sadly is a part of our community, at least in name only, you know, from basically coming onto campuses and stirring up trouble. It's not so much that their speech is hateful or unpopular. What the universities are trying to do is to keep the, you know, the campuses from going up in flames. The conservatives, you know, have long maintained that it's the left that, you know, stifles this and stifles this and stifles that. You know, I'm sorry, at the end of the day, and thank God we're not on broadcast radio, you all can go fuck yourselves. You know, the real truth of the matter is here, okay, Rob, and you and I have had this conversation numerous times. Okay, these are red herrings. These are false flags. This is them complaining because they don't like it when people point out the inconsistencies, the hypocrisies in their statements. They really don't like it when we point out to them that they're being evil, hateful human beings. Everybody's got free speech. Nobody's free speech is being stifled. The only thing that's happened is these college campuses and universities have taken steps, which I think are measured, smart steps, to protect the safety of the campuses, because 9 times out of 10, when these shitheads show up, they attract a bunch of followers who are not enrolled in the schools, by the way. They're not students at these institutions that go there and rabble-rouse and cause problems, and the next thing you know is you've got a mini-riot going on, okay? But unfortunately, as you know, the orange anus sitting behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, okay, promotes bullshit like this, and he sucks us all up because his base, the 30%, okay, of the United States that quite frankly is just a cesspool and a fetid, boil, ass, pus, crap, idiot part of humanity, goes along with this shit. Okay, Brody Rand over with. Go ahead, ask your question.
Yeah, I'm not... To be honest with you, you kind of lost me in some of your rant there. I'm not sure I've even followed. I mean, I definitely got the emotion. Got the emotional part of that. Got it down. This totally confuses me, however, because I don't – I mean, it's one thing about, you know, stifling somebody who is on campus speaking, but I don't quite get how you can – sort of force campuses to invite people who then get stifled. It seems a little circular to me. Like, you know, how does this actually work? It's not like, you know, because he signed this that now Berkeley is suddenly finds that it has to go out and invite Ann Coulter to speak on campus. I mean, it's like it just doesn't make sense to me in practical terms that this is really a real thing. Am I missing something?
Every lawyer, I tell you, Rob, every lawyer that I've talked to today, and these are attorneys who handle constitutional law. In fact, one I spoke to actually practices before the high court. This is just faintly, it's just grifting to his base, okay? Because at the end of the day, the Constitution of the United States protects free speech. What it doesn't protect, okay, are people like Ann Coulter, okay, who go into a crowded theater, yell fire when there is no fire, and there's a stampede. But see, when you look at someone like Trump and some of the morons in that White House and some of the people like Charlie Kirk, who are probably equally as ignorant, this is their messaging. They literally sell the message, okay, that their views as conservatives are being shut down. Now, interestingly enough, we're going to be talking to kids from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which is a relatively conservative campus, and it's in a definite red state. So it'll be interesting to hear kind of, you know, and especially since they're sitting as magazine editors, because they're in charge of a magazine where they are encouraging, okay, free expression and free speech, yet the conservatives, okay, would have a gigantic bowel movement over it, okay, and would bring a speaker on to talk about how evil homosexuality is and all this other nonsense, okay, and if that person was to cause a riot, okay, the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill cops obviously would be a little unhappy about that. The university would probably try to block that from happening, but now threats from Trump is, well, if you try to do that, we're going to take away funding for your research for whatever it is that UNC is researching. This is kind of how dumb this is.
No, I still don't get it, because to your point on Ann Coulter, it's like the thing that if I was these universities at this point, is thinking about who I'm making up my list before an invitation goes out. I mean, she and Milo and all these other people have no intrinsic right to suddenly show up on campus and demand a theater. I mean, they have to be invited. Somebody has to have at one point thought it was a good idea to invite said speakers on campus. So I get it in terms of, you know, if for some reason there was some mandated list of speakers that campuses had to have, but that then wouldn't exactly fall into the category of free speech. That would be mandated speech. So and maybe they do have some tricks up their sleeve to do this, but it seems like, to your point, this is pandering to a base on something that is in practical terms, not, you know, at least with this heads up, that campuses are going to be a little more thoughtful about who they invite. And should they invite somebody that is going to be, rabble-rousing, at this point they're going to be left to their own risk of speaking and, creating violence that they'll have to, be victim of. Which seems like an odd thing.
I mean, it's odd. Anyway. I had a senior official in the administration do the rough equivalent of the verbal throwing his hands up in the air, going, you know, more nonsense, more pandering. It's just more work and it's pointless. And at the end of the day, yeah. And this official actually said this. He said, at the end of the day, this clown's probably not going to be here in 2 years, and maybe by then this will go away. So it's just. The thing that's upsetting, I think, more than anything else, I know we got to get to our guests, but the thing that really upsets me about this is that, in a larger viewpoint, okay, this encapsulates everything that I've ever said to you about the divisiveness of the American political scene since this idiot took office, and it's one pylon. You know, one right after the other, after the other, after the other, just like, you know, his bloody Twitter feed. You know, it just, I look at that and it's like all of this. And it's just like, and people, you know, and I'm not American, you know that, I'm Canadian. I mean, we just kind of look at your country and just throw our hands up and go, yeah, they lost the plot. So anyway, I'm more excited to talk to our guests because young people are always such a pleasure to talk to. These two, in full transparency, I was introduced to Patrick from a friend of his who you know as well as I do, Charles Massey, who runs the Personal Stories Project with his husband Joseph Chan Massey in Los Angeles. Charlie's a really good guy. He highly recommended Patrick, you brought the magazine to my attention. As a senior editor for a wire service and a longtime journalist, I was really impressed with what I saw. But I think the thing that really impressed me the most, Rob, was the fact that these guys went out there and they had their mission. They knew what they were going to do. And I think what made it unique was, is for the first time in a long time, we actually got to see an authentic voice, okay, for a badly underrepresented part of even our community. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Okay, well, with that, and thanking them for their incredible patience, I want to welcome onto the show Patrick Rosemond and Cassandra Cassidy. Good evening, team. How are you guys?
We're Hi. Good. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Wake up. We're now ready for you. Sorry. So let's do our very graceful segue. What are your guys' thoughts about free speech on campus and this theory of somehow mandating a more conservative tunity, if that's what how this plays out?
It's incredibly – so this is Cassandra, not Patrick. But it's incredibly frustrating for a number of obvious reasons. UNC has seen so many administrators and also just, like, public people come and try to impede our free speech with the Confederate monument that we have on campus. And, I mean, there's been so many instances of this happening throughout our institution's history. So it's just so frustrating that it's still happening. It's something that comes up in our lives a lot more than I think people would think as college students. But we're at this time where we're really being faced with what free speech means and how we protect that right while also not letting people use that as an excuse to put down other people.
Yeah,
so
I agree with everything that Cass said.
Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was just going to say I agree with everything that Cass just said. To the full extent. Yeah.
So Brody characterized your campus, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as being somewhat conservative leaning and being part of a red state. Is that a fair characterization? Is that how you guys see the environment on the campus?
Yeah, I don't really see it as a very conservative campus. We're actually quite the opposite. We're a very liberal campus. But it is very true with being in a red state that we do stick out compared to a lot of other cities in North Carolina.
So and now I have a practical question. I want to make sure that I'm pronouncing the publication correctly. Is it Kultur Magazine?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Kultur and Couture.
That is exactly what I thought, and I'm so glad that I got that right. So beautiful, beautiful publication. I had a chance to look through the online version of it prior to you guys coming on. What is your vision? What is your hopes for the impact of this publication?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is we want students' voices to be heard, and we want all students to feel like they're represented in many ways that they're not represented in mainstream media, especially when it comes down to diversity of all types, especially sexuality and gender.
Okay. And what is the thinking and mindset that you're trying to affect? What do you see it as today, and where do you hope to move it in the future?
Yeah, so I'm actually a senior, so I'm getting ready to leave, which is really upsetting because just last semester we sort of changed the vision of Couture because it used to be a little more fashion-oriented, and then we sort of were thinking that if there isn't really room for fashion to not talk about the pertinent issues that are challenging people's identities. So my vision is that we are able to continue to write the articles that not everyone will love, and that we're able to improve our diversity and our inclusion, because Patrick and I, it's something that we've really been trying to work on this semester, because there's always room for improvement, especially considering that we're both white editors. And so I'm just hoping that in the future, even after I leave and even after Patrick leaves next year, that the people who take over Cold Tour understand that first and foremost, we're about diversity and we're about being diverse authentically and not just for the sake of it.
Yeah. And also just making sure that all students' voices are heard. And I mean, both in the magazine itself and institutionally, we want to make sure that we're representing all students and not just one type.
No, I think that's excellent. And I feel for you, Cassandra, being a senior, because I know that it's like taking your world and you're jumping away from it. And, you know, and it does change. I actually host another radio show as well as this one out here in California called Out in Santa Cruz. And pardon my long intro to this question, but it does have a point, and I promise I will get to it. But one of the things we tackle on there, similar to what you guys do thematically in Kultur, is gender fluidity and, you know, trying to break out of the binary. And we innocently thought we weren't having that controversial a show one time when we challenged McDonald's and their Happy Meals and why they had boy toys and girl toys. And they just didn't have toys. And it the phones lit up and people went crazy over our radical suggestion that toys be toys and not be genderfied. What are some of the articles you guys have published that have caused the greatest uproar?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because I would say that the last semester, our issue was the first one that we really got people reacting less than enthusiastically, because it was less of, oh, this designer did this, and more of, this politician did this. So I would say that our main feature last semester, our segment was called Borders, and or that was the theme of the issue, and the main feature on the different ways that borders have affected students at UNC with relation to like the migration situation or immigration situation, excuse me. And that got a lot of maybe not even criticism, but more surprise and sort of like why are a lot of questions of, you know, why is Kultur talking about this? You know, you're a fashion magazine, stick to fashion. That's one that people really weren't huge fans of. We also wrote about the Kavanaugh situation, because that's hard to deny, especially considering that UNC has a huge sexual assault problem. So those were sort of the big ones that people were either criticizing or more so just saying, you know, this isn't really your field, stay out of it.
I have to laugh at that, Cassandra, in that you guys got criticized for an article about breaking out of your personal borders, when what you were actually doing with the magazine was literally breaking out of your borders of being just a fashion magazine and, you know, sort of superficial and getting serious. So there's sort of some levels of irony. Patrick, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, talking more about the photo shoots themselves, we didn't really get a lot of backlash, but I could definitely see in certain environments that doing an all-queer prom photo shoot could receive some controversy, just to get listeners like an idea of like what our photo shoots actually look like. So, I mean, it's not like people are constantly telling us like, y'all are doing something wrong and we're empowered by that, and like we're trying to challenge norms, but it's not like we're facing backlash when we're walking to class or anything. So it's nothing crazy like that, but I do think that we could have the potential of that happening if people strongly disagreed with what we're doing at Kultur.
Well, let me ask you this, because again, as an editor, this is what I look at too. When you talk about fashion, and either of you can answer this, and just give me a second to kind of spin it out here. When you talk about fashion, you are actually talking about defining oneself. So if you talk about a sense of fashion and you talk about moving that in a needle one way or the other, as I have seen particularly over the last probably 30 years, where we've kind of gone to a space where the expression could be non-binary, or the expression could be one gender or the other, or it could be a mix of both. Or we have, there's a young man I know whose father is a famous actor. This young man's name is Jaden Smith, and Jaden is famous for defying the norms and conventions by wearing articles of clothing that normally would be associated with the other gender. So here's the question, now that I've laid the parameters out. Given that, you know, you guys are dealing in that environment, and college usually is a place where people have a tendency to be a little bit more expressive, would it not be true then that you breaking out of fashion would only make sense because fashion does make that kind of personal expression and statement? And either of you can answer that.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing from this question is more like my response is I think everyone should just be able to wear what they want to wear. And I mean, yeah, we are pushing boundaries, but it's more just like a reflection of what's happening on a bigger level. Yeah. So does that answer your question? I'm a little.
Did you see where I was going with that or no? Dead silence there.
Yeah, I think we need a little more explanation there, Brody.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Cassandra.
So the fact that fashion inherently is about breaking the boundary of defining yourself and representing yourself, and so then us as a fashion magazine breaking our own boundaries and redefining ourselves, I think you're perfectly right to make that sort of comparison, if I'm understanding you correctly, because fashion, and that's the other thing we deal with, is that fashion is perceived to be about the brand or about the way it looks, or you know, the big fashion houses, what they're making, but it's really more about how you feel. And I've never really encountered this because I don't know what it's like to, I wear what are traditionally considered, you know, women's clothing, but the effort to sort of get outside of the boundaries that you are confined in is, I'm assuming, you know, tremendously difficult. And so for us to do that, even on a magazine level, which is a more macro level, it's still super difficult, even with all the support we have. But I think you're completely right to say that as a fashion magazine, you know, what is more indicative of fashion than us being or changing who we are?
Okay, fair enough. I think that, and what I was getting at, you picked up on, I probably wasn't clear enough. What I was looking for, and it's just based on my experiences, one of the number one things that I've heard repeatedly from especially queer youth over the years is the pushback and the shoveback they get when they alter gender perceptions, even by the way they dress. I've had some youth who they bristle at the notion that they have to be so identified strictly by the way that they prefer, you know, to make their appearance, whether they're trans or lesbian or even gay for that matter. It's almost as if they don't like the labeling and the stereotyping. So conversely, as a magazine at a collegiate level, dealing with people who for the first time are away from home and learning really for all intents and purposes to be completely expressive, how much of an impact that is. That's really what I was getting at. And I guess I wasn't exactly clear what that was. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think it's also really cool because we're in a spot where institutionally we can give those students the opportunity to come in and be on the set of a photo shoot if they're male identifying and they want to play around with makeup, and we'll do that and we'll support that. And then we have the end product, which is the Tangible magazine, and that's being shared with so many other youths. And hopefully that'll inspire them to step outside of their comfort zone and explore a part of them that they've been wanting to explore.
Guys, one of the things, I mean, because I think the thing that happens through generations, and I don't want to generalize because I really love what you guys have put out there in terms of breaking boundaries and borders, and the borders of that I see strongly are age borders, where we assume one generation is going to be this way and then step over a border to another generation and it's going to be this way, when, of course, they're all diverse. But the breaking that binary thought pattern and being more gender fluid and, allowing that expression, do you find any conflict with that, with kind of the political climate right now that is so role-based, which is, you know, where people are identifying, you know, strongly as being X, Y, and Z, and that is part of identity politics? Or, you know, are those two in concert with each other, or are they fighting each other?
I would say, what would I say, actually? I think that it's hard to ignore the impact of politics on the way we deal with people breaking out of the binary. But I also think that it isn't, or I think that our generation is able to and has taken on the role of fighting the need to identify and fit into one box. And I think young people my age are doing a good job at just resisting and not really letting that get to them, if that makes sense. I don't know, Patrick. What
no,
you
yeah, I, that totally does.
Yeah, I agree. I wish we lived in a world where your gender wouldn't be politicized. And I think my generation is doing a better job of supporting, you know, gender fluidity. But yeah, I mean, you can't really help how other generations above us, or who knows, like what's to come, are going to feel.
Yeah, this is sort of. Go ahead,
Rudy. I'm listening to what they're saying, and I'm sorry, and I think I'd like you to finish, because mine's kind of more editorially aimed than yours probably, so go ahead.
Okay, yeah. No, I was just going to make a point or a characteristic point of where this kind of came out. Katie Couric did a series on being transgender, and in the series she had an interview with an older transgender woman and a younger transgender woman, and the older woman was very adamant that even in a transgender sense, there are two genders, and you were, you know, you may have been, you know, biologically perceived as one, but you transitioned to, boom, the second gender or the other gender. And the younger woman was saying, you know, there's also in between that isn't, you know, it's not quite like that, that there's, you know, you don't necessarily have to go pole to pole. And which is, I don't know, honestly, that is a concept that an older person couldn't grasp. I think it's just an idea that was not presentable, or was presented or at least conscious in older times. And now I think it's that art and fashion and things have evolved that allowed that concept to be there. And as younger people are in an environment where you are allowed more self-expression than we were, it's sort of like, okay, now that I'm allowed my self-expression, guess what? I'm not A or B. I'm actually A, B in the middle. you know, or I'd rather not even identify that at all. And that is how I truly am finding on self-reflection and how I see myself. So I just love what you guys are doing, because I think that is what you are giving people the freedom to explore and to embrace. So, Brody, now your editorial question.
Well, now see, I can actually piggyback on that, because you actually, you know, you gave me my segue. And, Cassandra, I understand, you know, you being a senior and Patrick, you being a junior. But as an editor, my immediate question is legacy. So who picks up the ball and runs with it after you guys are gone?
After we're done, we are going to select two associates to shadow me and my co-editor, Caroline Farrell. And we will teach them everything for a year, and then it'll be passed on to them once we're done.
Okay. Well, the nitty-gritty of it is, what do you see as your mission and your legacy statement now as compared to where you could see it, say, since you're obviously changing some of your perceptions editorially in terms of your photo shoots and everything, how do you see yourself working that into the program as well, moving forward?
Yeah, moving forward, our mission statement will stay the same, but also you just don't know what the future holds and things could change. But hopefully we get to a level where we are not only just saying our mission statement, but we're constantly living it, both as an institution and within the magazine itself. And yeah, I mean, that's all that I could hope for it. And I think once we get down the road, there's going to be a lot more goals that are just going to come that we just don't even know of right now.
Yeah, as a senior,
something I'm really thinking about is what's going to happen come May, when I no longer have control over or co-control over the publication, because I've put so many hours into it. And something that I really want people to know after I'm gone is that it sounds a bit much.
I know this sounded so morbid.
It did. But this magazine really is. It really is our child. It's so close to home that I honestly can't even imagine what it's going to be like without it, without waking up to a million messages. But what I'm hoping is that in the future, we have become so progressive to the point, or so inclusive, I'll say, to the point that we're not even, to the point that we don't even have to be considered or label ourselves inclusive. And what I mean by that is, instead of having our theme be borders and having the photo shoot be explicitly, you know, for queer students, I'm hoping that we can do that in the broader concept of our magazine without having to try so hard, if that makes sense. So instead of going into a photo shoot with the intention that our models are going to be non-binary, I hope that that's just I hope that we are able to attract people who feel comfortable with couture to the point that they can express themselves fully. So in a way, I almost want us to become so inclusive that it's not that people say, oh, couture is, you know, the inclusive fashion magazine. You know, I want us to be a magazine that is just for everyone, and that to be self-explanatory.
Okay, fair enough.
I think that's great. I'm sorry. I just had to laugh at your ultimate or your imminent demise, which was like, you know, it's like just, you know, I want you guys, you know, I was already thinking about you guys, you know, bursting forth out of the cocoon that is, you know, the college world and bringing this forth into the much broader culture. And because I think it's sorely needed. I mean, we're so boxed in. I mean, you look at, you know, like the red carpets at these award shows, and you know, I know it seems slightly demeaning that the women are subjected to who are you wearing and, you know, what's your design and all this stuff. But I have to laugh because I see the men step up and it's like, oh, who are you wearing? Da, da, da. And it's like, what are you talking about? He's wearing a black suit, just like the last guy wore a black suit. And the guy before wore, okay, a white suit. It's like there's no art, no creativity. Mm-hmm. It's like the women have literally all the fun in those situations. And so I am mm-hmm. really hopeful that what you guys are doing bursts forth into our broader culture, and that this is not your demise, but your springboard. So with that, I'll ask my question. What is next for you guys once you do break out of the college environment?
Yeah, I'm still figuring that out. I think I have a lot of time to hopefully make those plans, but either I want to go into journalism and report on the LGBTQ community and possibly work for a big publication like Out Magazine or maybe something that's more news-based. But I could also see myself taking the fashion route and working on fashion campaigns, doing art direction and piecing together these cool photo shoots. But I really don't know. I think more than anything, I want to have impact for queer youth, for sure.
Cassandra, how about you?
It's a question I definitely get a lot as a second semester senior. And I don't think there's really nothing for me to say except I don't know. I came to college really invested in NGOs and women's access to or people's access to menstrual pads and sanitary products. And then I sort of switched and started getting really into fashion, and now I'm more into journalism. I'm interested in everything from law school to getting my MBA to getting a PhD in economics to working at an advertising agency or writing a novel or traveling or living on my family's farm in Ireland. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm still so young, and I'm trying to, instead of feel the pressure that I need to make an impact right now, I'm going to wait. I don't know what really my quote-unquote calling is yet. Patrick is really passionate about helping queer youth, and that's sort of the thing he knows in his heart, and I just don't know that yet. So I'll say to you what I say to my parents every time they ask me if I have a job yet, which is stay tuned.
We don't know.
Well,
okay.
I wasn't. Yeah, no,
wow.
It's totally okay. And I love the variety of things that you have in front of you. And Patrick, I'm going to put on, because I've got two 16-year-old sons, so I'm going to put on my gay dad hat with you a little bit and just give you some advice. I hope you embrace the concepts that you guys are working on, which is to break out of your borders. And really, I think some of the areas that you could help queer youth the most is by affecting the world at large. The other gentleman on the line here, Brody Levesque, is a renowned journalist. No adjective in front. He happens to be LGBT, but he is a renowned journalist. And the contribution he brings by bringing just that perspective to the whole of journalism is hugely valuable. So I wish that for you is that you get out and make your impact and do it in a broad sense and not limit yourself to just an LGBT house speaking to the choir, because what you guys are doing is phenomenal. You guys have a mission, and I really hope you take it out to the whole of our world and not just to people who are already nodding their heads yes. So I'm off my soapbox now, and I'll turn it over to Brody.
And I'm going to have to second the motion. And with that, Your Honor, the Commonwealth rests its case. I agree with Rob. I think really critically important. And Cassandra, you've got a bloody good, Instagram feed coming. I can just tell right now. I'm going to have to find you and follow you. I think that looking at, and in fairness, I'm half Irish, and my mom's from Carrickon. Shannon and grew up in Belfast, so yeah, I kind of identify with what you're saying with parents. I think at the other end of the spectrum, though, it's really important that both of you understand that your generation has more of an authentic voice and more of a contribution to make than my generation, and I'm a baby boomer. And I think in many ways, probably even more so than Generation X or even the ones that, you know, you're preceding. And the reason I say that is because you are the children of a different age, of an age that I don't think many of us would have probably conceptualized when we were kids. And it manifests itself in things from the very tragic being turned into a very good thing, like we saw with the kids that Marcus Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, to the kids at Pulse, to the kids that were getting out the vote, to the kids of Black Lives Matter, to just the people that really care. I think that it's critically important, especially on a global basis, that you guys continue that. One of the reasons that I enjoyed looking through the magazine is because I could see that vision, because it absolutely, I thought, reflected well, not only on you as individuals, but as you as a generational thing. And with that, I'll toss it back to Rob.
Yeah. So, guys, one of the questions I like to ask at the end of our shows, because we don't know everything, is what question didn't we ask that we should have asked you guys?
I'm trying to think of a question. The journalist in me. I don't know. Cass, do you have a question?
I think the question we get a lot is, what's your favorite part about being an editor of Kultur? Or what's the next big thing you're working on? And those are pretty cliche, so I'm not sure if I even want to answer
them. Yeah, I was going to say, those sound like border questions, and as we've already said, we're not going to do borders here tonight. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, so let me ask the real practical question. How do people find Kultur magazine? We're not on.
Yeah, campus. You can. Yeah, so we put out digital issues at kultur.org, and you can also follow us on Instagram at kulturmag.
Well, excellent. You guys are terrific. We've had a great time having you on here. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for being who you are. Thank you for doing what you're doing, and please, please, please continue doing it in the future. You know, your viewpoint and your impact is definitely needed. I want to thank Brody Levesque, as always, for helping both produce the show and co-host. Absolutely could not do this without you. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in every week. We love you, and we appreciate you, and we are open to your suggestions always. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz. That is Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear that on www.ksco.com, and you'll hear my voice on that show as well. As for Rated LGBT Radio, we will be back next week at the same time on this same channel, and you can find our previous shows at blogtalk.com/ratedLGBTradio, and please check those out. They are well worth all the listening. So for Brody and myself tonight, and bid you a good night.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.